Hello and welcome along to the RT Rugby Podcast with me, Neil Tracy. First up today, a little bit of housekeeping. This is the second podcast of the week from us. If you want to hear our Women's Six Nations preview, then that went up yesterday on the RT News app and wherever you get your podcasts. I spoke to head coach Scott Beaman, second row Fiona Chute and senior coach John McKee ahead of this weekend's opener against France in Le Mans. So if you want to hear that, just go back in your timeline and you'll get it there. This podcast is going to be around our Men's Six Nations wrap and a few URC talking points ahead of that returning this weekend. Bernard Jackman is back from Cheltenham and with us, and Johnny Murphy's also here today. Bert, you got home in one piece?
Yeah, still alive. What a week. Twickenham, Cardiff, Cheltenham, Leon, RDS for the schools, Schools Cup final, which was a great event as well. So, yeah, jam-packed. And I'm going to Florida. I'm going to Florida tomorrow for League of Nations, Longines League of Nations show jumping event. So for my other job. So living the dream at the moment. Can't complain.
You were definitely on the school drop-offs yesterday and this morning.
I'm very lucky. I don't contribute much to the house. I have good support here, but I have a lot of IOUs to pay back when I get home.
Yeah.
Pound for pound. What was the highlight then of the last 10 days or so?
Galloping the Champ, winning the Gold Cup, back to back. Look at obviously Twickenham. I thought Twickenham was an unbelievable experience, an atmosphere, but obviously we lost. And then I think Ireland winning the Six Nations was great, an amazing achievement, but probably because it wasn't a Grand Slam, didn't have the same impact. I think, being there for Galloping the Champ and seeing the reaction he got, like, I think sports people, sports fans, they admire greatness, and that was a horse that 8 years of age has gone back to back. Whereas in the rugby, we had some great rugby, but I don't think we had any team that basically blew us away. You know, Ireland obviously started like that, we're going to, but dipped off a little bit. England, France came strong at the end. Italy have had a great competition, but yeah, unfortunately for me, from a rugby point of view, it was a horse racing event that caught my eye.
There seems to be a lot of admiration for rugby within the horse racing circles, though, from your interviews and stuff you're doing last year.
Yeah, it's amazing. Look at sports people tend to love other sports and admire other sports people. And what blew me away, Johnny, was access. I mean, and obviously coming from rugby, speaking to a load of journalists over there who are feature writers, and they just can't get access to rugby players or GA players as much as they used to. But you know, Willie Mullins is probably the busiest man in horse training, and he gives time to journalists, likewise all the jockeys, and they seem to really understand that they have to sell their sport, and that was what blew me away, was just access and time that they gave us. And I think apparently this year's Netflix doc will be much better, because players saw last year, they realized it's not a hatchet job. And whereas last year they were begging people to take part, I think now they're trying to, everybody wants to take part, and they're trying to work out who are the best characters and the best stories. So it just takes a while for the penny to drop. And I think hopefully in rugby it is going to start to drop now, and you know, that people get to tell their story, and I suppose the fans get to understand those individuals who we admire so much on the pitch, about what makes them tick and where they're coming from, where they want to go.
To stay on that point, actually, like, I mean, I'm certain if you were a player and you would have seen the likes of Andrew Porter or Seb Negri or Finn Russell over the course of that Netflix series, and see how popular they were becoming off the back of it, how much people were engaging with them. Like, you have a life to carry on after you quit rugby. And if you can make yourself a little bit of a name from telling people your story on a documentary like that, and then look at the course of this championship. I don't think it affected Andrew Porter's performances.
Yeah.
Seb Negri obviously got injured and missed a lot of the championship, but Finn Russell, okay, Scotland's kind of thing tailed away, but I mean, he was his usual self. I don't think any of the players that were featured in last season's Netflix documentary, you know, let the fame go to their head or anything. Like, I mean, it's a bit of a no-brainer, I think, if you're a player, isn't it?
Yeah, and from my understanding, Neil is speaking to some of the English agents. You know, they sat down with their players and said, look, you know, you need to be a little bit more open here. There's no harm in this. There's no downside. It's just actually an opportunity for you to talk about or show them who you are. And from my understanding is the Irish lads have been more open as well. Look at it. To be fair, it was rushed in last year. Mm. There was no dialogue when the players and the players' representatives heard what the overall fee was and what their kickback to the unions was. They felt they'd undersold it. But I think now they understand that it's big picture stuff. You're competing with darts. You're competing with everything for eyes. The way the game has gone, the way the sport has gone, those behind the scenes documentaries have a role to play in terms of, I suppose, keeping current fans engaged or deepening their connection and also potentially finding new fans. I do believe that next year's going to be better. It's interesting. I heard the producer on a podcast somewhere else, and he said it was the third season of Drive to Survive before they kind of felt that the teams were comfortable with them. And that's when they reckon that was their best episode or the best season. So it's not just rugby that maybe takes a while to be convinced. But we've got some brilliant players, brilliant characters, and just a case of seeing a bit more of them. You know, like Mac Hansen, like I've done some stuff with Mac, and I know he's very open. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's very open, and it's great. And people enjoy him and understand him a little bit better when they spend time with him.
Yeah, like we've spoken about it before in terms of like sport is ultimately it's an entertainment industry, regardless of whether in terms of where we are now, the commercialization of sport in general. I think every sport has to realize that, you know, we're in an entertainment industry now. People want, they want to build connection. They want to understand stories. They want to know people more. And in the social media age, the opportunity for someone to, you know, like it or not, build their brand or get, or if they have a story that they want to tell that drives them on, every sport has a duty that they have to be able to give that to people and also let them tell it their way. Not be, you know, not like when, you know, myself and Bert played, did say something in an interview and the media manager, like, you can't say that. Like, I remember saying after we lost one game before Europe, saying, oh, we had a meeting, players had a meeting this morning, we spoke about it and on we go. And I remember Tony McGann was the coach at the time, pulled me and said, what are you saying? I was like, what? I said, we had a meeting in the morning. What? We did. Like, what's the issue here? And it needs to change. And I think it is changing. And you know, moments like, you know, the atmosphere, if they could have captured the atmosphere, or if they managed to get what that conversation between Steve and Andy was at halftime, you know, the atmosphere in France this weekend, by all accounts, Birch was supposed to have been incredible. The stadium looked amazing. To capture all that, it's entertainment. And we need to sell that. We need to sell our sport and get more people involved across the board.
Yeah, like, and even Netflix aside, it was just while we were talking about it, it popped into my head as well. One of the most enjoyable things I listened to over the course of the last 6 weeks was the week of the Ireland-England game. Two of your old Leicester teammates, Johnny, Ben Youngs and Dan Cole, have a new podcast together. And I think it was the Wednesday or Thursday, or maybe a little bit earlier in the week, that Ireland were playing England. They essentially did a full podcast episode talking about why is Andy Farrell such an excellent coach, what it's like to work under him, give us insights. And I mean, I know Ben Youngs isn't playing anymore, but Dan Cole was going out that weekend. And I found it so refreshing to see like a current player who was going to be up against that head coach sit down and have no problem just kind of giving insights into him, telling us about him, being engaging, being funny at times, being serious at times as well, and it not being a worry that it's going to affect his performance on Saturday.
Yeah, and like the thing about Coley is like Coley was always a grumpy old man, like always, even when he was a 17-year-old kid in the academy. But like he has the funniest dry wit sense of humor.
And yeah, I've been listening to a few episodes. I'm really enjoying it.
And he'll pull out a zinger out of nowhere and it will erupt the changing room. Like he is brilliant and he's always been like that. Like Ben has always been a bit of a messer and he has that, you know, view. I suppose like he's an exceptional player, but you know, for Coley to be able to show that, that's what Coley is really like, you know, like having a coffee with Coley is really enjoyable. Like, you know, where people might see him as, you know, very serious, you know, kind of dour to an extent. But when you know him, he's such good company. And I think, like, I've listened to a few of those and seeing Coley kind of put himself out there more, he's just, he's hilarious. You know, it's great. It's, for someone like Coley, it's dead.
Front rows universally have the better personalities, Birch. Is that right?
When they're not talking about
scrums. I must have missed out when I was school that day, you know, but they do. They are good. And even like Ellis Genge, I thought he came across brilliantly in that documentary as well. They were generally much maligned characters, but it can drive some of them to being very witty.
All right. That's a roundabout way to get us into the actual Six Nations and a review of the championship. Ireland, though. Let's start here. Ireland, Johnny, Six Nations champions, 4 wins and a defeat. If you were to go back, I can't remember, you were you on with us the week of the first game against France? If we went back to that preview podcast we did in the last week of January, and you had told us all that day Ireland were going to win the championship with 4 wins, only defeat would be away in Twickenham, I think we all probably would have snapped your hand off for it.
Yeah, well, I think Birch was the one that said he was a bit worried about what's about to happen going forward. He thought there might be been a bit of a hang. And there, look, they didn't play their best rugby in any way over the last, you know, what they have played over the last 2 years. Probably the highlight from a performance perspective of what was what they did to France on the opening night, and then everyone got really excited about that. But I think definitely after the World Cup disappointment, you know, you look at historically what can happen after World Cups to Ireland in the Six Nations and you know, the hangover that can be there. You know, they were 90 seconds away from, you know, doing back-to-back Grand Slams. And I think they, you know, they got their performances right. They had some moments of brilliance. They had some moments where they probably need to work on ahead of going to South Africa. But 100%, I think winning the championship, you know, last week in January, everyone, you know, would have taken it. I just think after how they performed on the Friday night of the opening night, I think just everyone got a bit kind of, you know, overexcited, like when we all did, you know. But yeah, in general, I think it'd be a really good box ticked, get them back into the winning mentality, and then head into what is an absolute monster of a summer series against South Africa.
Yeah, and we'll get to that summer series in a little while as well. Like, to follow it on, though, on the championship, Birch, like, when you factor in, okay, they had the disappointment of Twickenham, and in fairness, the coaches and players after the Scotland game on Saturday, they were honest and open enough to say that, like, that defeat did hang around with them for a lot of the week. Even heading in towards Thursday, they said they were still kind of feeling the effects of it and just kind of, it was just hanging over them. But when you factor in that this was Ireland continuing on and winning a Six Nations, when they've had to throw Jack Crowley in as Johnny Sexton's replacement. I know he's played for Ireland in the last couple of seasons beforehand, but, you know, this was his first year taking on that leadership of the team, or leadership of the attack. You also had Joe McCarthy getting properly blooded now into being a full-time Ireland international. And then coming into the championship as well, we had this massive question over what were we going to do on the right wing, where we were missing Hugo Keenan and Jimmy O'Brien, and Calvin Nash seamlessly fitted in across those 5 matches. And then throw in on top of it as well, Hugo Keenan ended up missing a couple of matches and the sky didn't fall down. Like, there's a lot of positives coming out of it.
No, there is. And I think Nash and Joe were totally unproven, you know, at that level. Obviously, both being excellent. Well, Nash for years has been an excellent player, but over the last year and a half for Munster has really shown up. Joe is obviously a late developer, but we were all very excited about him. Had the form in the European Cup coming into this to make us believe that he was going to have an impact, and he did. Particularly against France, quieter obviously in the game since then, and very quiet worryingly against England. But that's, he's, you know, he's a young player. Jack, I think it's massive for us. I think it's massive for Jack to win a Six Nations in his first season as the starting 10. And I think he had a really good tournament, and we can certainly build build a team around him over foreseeable future. But yes, I sound like ungrateful here, but I felt you can't be as happy about the Six Nations as we should be because of kind of how the last 2 weeks went. And particularly, I understand England. I actually think England are going to be a phenomenal side. And
yeah.
they're going to be our main threat over the next 3 or 4 years. But Scotland, like, there wasn't the backlash that you would have hoped for having lost England. And I know there was not much time. But Scotland gave us a lot of difficulty. Scotland shut us down pretty well. Our much famed and much lauded attack game, which is brilliant and statistically the best attack in the competition by a mile. But I just thought the last 2 weeks we struggled a little bit, and that's going to be the challenge now for Andrew Goodman and the rest of the coaches is to just find subtle changes to it that can make us a little bit more unpredictable. Because I don't think Scotland are the most physical team in the world, but they were able to manhandle us in the collision, which I was surprised and disappointed by. I know we had loads of A zone entry, but we didn't convert them, etc. But yeah, I just think that kind of killed it a little bit. And even the players, I felt at the end there wasn't that same satisfaction immediately. Obviously, they, you know, after a couple of minutes they realized what a big achievement it was, and like some of those players having 5-6 Nations titles is phenomenal. I mean, you know, it's an amazing success on their CV. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of think England and France are the two teams who finished the tournament with momentum, and we maybe didn't. But over the course of the competition, obviously we were the best. But yeah, I'm not as gung-ho about it as I probably thought I would be if having won a Six Nations, if you get me.
On that Scotland game then, and why Ireland really, really struggled to put them away, particularly in the third quarter where it was probably as dominant as Ireland have been at any stage in the championship. Johnny, when I was watching it back on Sunday, I was kind of caught between two different stations on it, where on the one hand, you were looking at it going, there's absolutely no way, even with the benefit of hindsight, obviously, there's no way Ireland are losing this game. Scotland have not had a sniff of an attack for about 40 minutes. But then there's the frustration where Ireland, despite being utterly dominant and getting into the 22 at will, once they got within 5 meters out, were just struggling to make an impact. And like, are we back to a stage now where when you get up into those close little quarters and those short phases where it's kind of like picking jams up towards the line, Ireland and Irish teams are still struggling to have the power to just knock teams over and bowl teams over in those areas?
Yeah, I think there was a couple of times where they could have probably pulled the trigger to go to width a bit earlier. They created those kind of 2v1s or 3v1s on the edges, but they played an extra phase, or they hit a forward coming around the corner rather than going in behind, particularly there's two on the left-hand side. And that's just a bit of probably control at 9 or 10, or, you know, just being able to just to play to that space at the right time. The whole point on the pick and jams is if you can't score, it's to get them close so you can then probably race them to that edge. And they just missed a couple of those opportunities. And then when they did go wide, it was probably a phase or potentially two phases too late when they got swallowed up and they had to regenerate and go again. Scotland defensively, obviously Bert's already said it around, you know, how physical they were. They had a huge amount, you know, they managed to keep a lot of numbers on their feet as well. So Ireland looked a bit lateral at times. It was a clear tactic, obviously, defensively to try and get as many people be as aggressive as possible in the contact zone and then have, you know, 11, 12 guys on your feet filling the field. And then, you know, which then with Ireland, when they're trying to get to width, they're not creating that. They're not creating that 2v1 or 3v2 that we've seen all the time. So it was a very good tactic, and Scotland defended very, very well. I think just in the green zone or A zone, whatever you want to call it, they didn't pull the trigger a couple of times when those spaces were available for them, and that ultimately cost them trying to convert. And then they were unlucky with a call or two, whether they, you know, they, you know, furlongs try, whether it was or wasn't, but, you know, they got it, it leveled itself out over the course of the 80 minutes.
The counter argument, if someone was being an eternal optimist here, Bernard, is the counter argument that if Ireland were 5% better in that third quarter, they probably would have won the game by 25 points, where you have, I know we're talking about the dead opportunities maybe where they didn't pull the trigger quick enough, but then you also have Gary Ringrose spilling a ball when he was charging on towards the line. Calvin Nash just stepping back into the left when if he'd pushed off towards the right, he probably dives over the try line. Where Tadhg Furlong, that ball just, that skids out of his hands. On another day, that probably is awarded as a try. Robbie Henshaw, it was a great held up. It was great from Cameron Redpath to hold it up. But on another day, you know, if he's just marginally better, he's able to ground that ball down. Like, it wasn't even as if they were not giving themselves the opportunity to score. It was just the tiniest of tiny errors were creeping in.
Yeah, like, absolutely. No, I said we had loads of opportunities, but we didn't finish them off, and a variety of different things: good defense, bad decision making, or drop balls. But that's the game, you know. And like, we expect your teams to. I definitely just maybe expect a little bit more, given how comfortably we've beaten Scotland in the World Cup. Given how there was so much on the line, given how we'd lost the previous week, it was a real opportunity just to go out and tear them apart. I think, look, I would say there's an element of fatigue there. There's an element of maybe we're a little bit predictable, attack-wise, you know, and, you know, it goes back to the last sequence against New Zealand. You know, when New Zealand for 4 minutes defended without really looking like getting breached, and we said, oh, paint by numbers attack. I think we have been a little bit paint by numbers at times, and Wales are a very average team, did a fairly decent job of shutting us out. You know, it was only, and there was errors in that, but where the errors coming from? They're coming from basically not affecting that defensive line, not getting numbers off their feet, not creating slight overlaps, and getting frustrated and throwing balls on the ground or getting held up in a tackle, etc. So I do think that's the challenge. I also have been disappointed with our set piece launch in the competition, you know, and there's recency bias, but like, you know, England and Italy this weekend scored beautiful tries off set piece, you know, and even going back to the game against Ireland, last play of the game, four-man line-out, 14 against 15, we had 15, they had 14, and England, you know, got that edge on us, got that gain line off the line out with a nice strike play, and it was the second phase that Faber Boso gets gain line, and we give away a penalty. Like that, I think our phase attack is good and allows us, you know, keep the ball for long periods. But I just thought we were a little bit predictable, and that's, look, when you win a championship without, you know, being innovative, and maybe being a little bit tired, that's a fair sign. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm not. Loads of people are really looking forward to South Africa, and I think it will be a great test series. But I think this Irish team, some of them need a break. You know, if Leinster go deep in Europe, you know, a lot of those same players are going to have to go to the well again quite a bit this season, and obviously URC as well, and they're the same fellas we'd be asking to basically, you know, put their shoulder pads on and go out and beat the box. And does it really, how important really is it at this stage, to this summer tour, if you're not actually going to give yourself a better chance of being able to go for the three-peat next year? You know, that'd be my worry, is that we overflog our players for a summer tour, what, 3 years out from a World Cup, when other teams like England in particular and France have now found genuine stars. I think this Six Nations, did we find genuine stars? Jack Crowley, yeah, but we kind of knew he was next in anyway. Like France didn't know, France weren't sure about Le Garec. They weren't sure he had the quality to be a proper, proper international star. And I think he has. The Porter, I think, has the potential to replace Dante. Faye Wabosso is going to be right winger for England for all his career. That's the only thing I would say is that England now with George Martin and Ollie Chesham at six look like have a pack who can go toe to toe with anybody. You know what I mean? That's my back of my mind. And look, I'm being hyper critical here, but I'm just trying to look forward. That the summer tour will be really interesting. Is in do we go and with you know all the tried and tested players and try and get something when South Africa are already thinking about the next big thing, you know?
But moving on to that summer tour in South Africa, Johnny, like we talk about, do we go with the tried and tested players as well? Do we have to bear in mind as well, it's 8 years since Ireland played in South Africa, and like so many of these players in the Ireland team probably haven't actually played, certainly haven't played a test match in South Africa. A lot of the high profile internationals probably haven't even played a game over there because they probably wouldn't have been brought over by Leinster or maybe by Munster in previous seasons on their tours when it might have been a rotated squad going down there. Like, I'm just off the top of my head thinking through players like Andrew Porter wouldn't have played a test down in South Africa. Dan Sheehan wouldn't have played a test down in South Africa. Tyke Byrne, most of those across the bat, maybe Van der Fleer probably would have been there in 2016. But Caelan Doris, Gibson Park, Jack Craig, I mean, the core of that team wouldn't have played a test down in South Africa. So, like, it's going to be an enormous opportunity for them to experience it this summer.
Yeah, it is. I don't think Birch is saying, like, you know, bring down an emerging Ireland tour. I do think that it's, you know, the likes of, say, Ryan Baird, it's an opportunity for him to get, you know, 2-3 games on the bounce, test like him, you know, and guys who are on the periphery, you know, give them an opportunity and blood those guys. But there are, you know, the core of that team is going to travel. It's then your decision around, you know, guys like, I suppose, Pete, or, you know, when is he going to finish? Is he going to finish over there? Or is he finished, you know, from an Irish perspective? He didn't answer that question after the game. But does that then give Ryan Baird an opportunity to go out and start at six and be, you know, Birch has already said about Ollie Chesham, Ryan Baird has the opportunity to probably influence an Irish game in my opinion, probably in a better way because of his athletic ability. I think he had more than Chesham. Chesham is amazing, but I think in open field, someone like Ryan Baird, he's like, you know, Tom Croft, he could be the Irish Tom Croft, who is just that, you know, his speed and power is a point of difference that you don't get in forwards very, very often. And a good summer tour for him, a good season next year playing for Ireland. Does Andy Farr look at him for a Lions spot? You know, like, that's where he's at. So it's the opportunity for the guys like that to go and experience, you know, a longer test, a longer tour environment, and put themselves under a bit of pressure. But yeah, it's what way they want to see it. But there are guys that are going to need a break, you know, because they've been away for their families a long time, you know, and it's then, you know, who goes next. For instance, Jamie Osborne hasn't had a whole lot of, you know, a whole lot of minutes. He hasn't been capped yet. He's been in and around the Irish squad for nearly 18 months. Does he go get a rattle at 12? You know, it's a big ask, but does that happen? It's the likes of those guys that are in and around the squad. Does Sam Prendergast go? You know, these younger guys that have been in, you know, Ollie Yeager getting an opportunity. He's obviously played there with the Crusaders a bit. So, you know, these guys that are in and around the periphery of the squad from a development perspective, it's do they bring those guys and then actually give them a cap and see where they're at?
The Ryan Baird one is really interesting, Bernard, because it's like, obviously we're going to find out in the next couple of weeks what Peter O'Mahony's plans are. In fairness to him, like he said it after the match on Saturday, he's going to sit down with his family and talk through things this week. It'd be unfair to say that it was definitely his last game or last home game for Ireland at the weekend, but you know, you don't have to be a body language expert to see him before and after that match and think he looked like someone at the very least who knew it could be his last game for Ireland in Ireland. If he did decide that he was going to call it a day at the end of the season, whether it be just for Test rugby or for rugby in general, would you bring him on that tour of South Africa to give him his swan song, his, you know, what a great way to go out, a big tour in South Africa? Or are those two games in South Africa as good an opportunity as you're going to get to put Ryan Baird in or another six and see how they handle it?
Yeah, I wouldn't be bringing him, Connor. I would think about not bringing Tig. I would think about not bringing Bundy. You know, I would probably 4 or 5 players I would just rest up. You know what I mean? I'd rest up and think about the next year. Or no, it depends. Yeah, that's what I would do. And I think his swan song, you know, he had a nice swan song. A lot of players didn't get to captain their country, you know, for a Six Nations title. And I hope it's not the end. I hope next November he's still there. And I do think a contract is part of that decision. I mean, it's a very unusual situation. You know, one, first of all, a lot of players don't get to choose their, you know, their ending. And so Pete has already, you know, achieved more than them for that. But realistically, this one's a little bit different because, you know, he wanted to play on. He wanted to re-sign for next year. And obviously the whole contract situation left a bad taste in his mouth. And that's still not rectified. So I think it's not as straightforward as a player deciding to finish on their own terms. I think that's sad, really. I think it's sad. But regardless of whether he plays on next year or not, I have no issue with Pete being, or Connor or any of those lads, being in the Irish squad next year if they're better than what we have. But I do think a summer tour on the back of a World Cup year, on the back of a Six Nations where they've been, you know, heavily involved, is maybe an opportunity just to test the next level down. And like for Tadhg Furlong, for example, I mean, Beelum has been a very good... Tadhg's form is good. I've no issue there. I'm talking about resting him rather than dropping him. And same with the others. Bundy Aki's form is brilliant, but I'm just talking about minding him so that next year he is fresh, fit, and ready to perform for Connacht and Ireland. But just Tadhg's position, like Ollie Yeager is now available to us. We didn't have him a year ago. You know, he's done well for Munster. Finney Beelum, his age profile, you know, he's
32, I think.
So, yeah, he's 32. So like, he hasn't got 10 years left, but he, you know, he's still, but like, wouldn't be a great boost for him to be our starting tight head against the box and let him go. You know, that's what I think. And Ollie Yeager to get significant time. So then next year we have 3 very good tight heads that are proven at international level. That's kind of where I'm thinking.
Before I move on, actually, just when you mentioned Tadhg Furlong, I thought on Saturday, I know he got held, I know he'll be really, really sickened about that try that he'll think he should have scored. I thought that was as good as he's looked in a long, long time on Saturday. I'm talking everything around the pitch, because I think we've kind of seen a change in his game now that he's gone into his 30s, where he probably doesn't have the explosiveness around the pitch where, you know, we'd often joke he was like a back at times out there with his ball skills and stuff, where he's probably doing and had to change his game to become a little bit more hard-nosed and do some of the less glamorous stuff. And I think in the last few months, we're starting to see him get comfortable doing that. And then in terms of just like the basics of scrummaging, like that Irish scrum was as good as it's looked on Saturday for a long, long time as well.
Yeah, it was incredible. And the Scots were shocked at how dominant we were in that area. I think players like Tadhg, with the amount of stress that's been on their bodies over the years, it's only natural sometimes they're going to have played broken. You know what I mean? And I think he was playing with his body not right, but yet he was still better than what we had, but his form dipped a little bit. But I think you're seeing him now in a good place physically and back towards the best. But a lot of people won't agree with this, but my opinion would be, you know, while his body is good, it's still a great opportunity to rest him. Like, if the Irish program, the player management is the envy of world rugby, this is an opportunity. And you look at the All Blacks, you know, they've given sabbaticals and things like that. I'm not asking for sabbatical. I'm just thinking that this is the year, maybe going to South Africa, even though it's obviously a chance to win a test series in South Africa and on the back of a test series in New Zealand. That's another scalp for this team who are breaking records, etc. But I just don't know if the long-term gain, if the risk is worth what's ahead of them next year and the year after. You know, like next summer, Tyke Furlong is going to be on a Lions tour, you know, and that's going to be incredibly physically draining and emotionally draining. So that's kind of where my logic is.
I think a good example of a player who would have taken a summer off would have been, I think it was this Kian Healy, Johnny, the year, it was like the year after he came back from his kind of 2 years of injury hell, where I think it might have been 2017 or 20, maybe 2017 or something like that, where he had just come back and he was kind of getting into the swing of things again. And it's off the top of my head now, whatever summer tour was going on at that time, he sat out from it. And look at him now, 5-6 years down the line.
Yeah, and I think, like, I would agree with Bert. There's an opportunity to give guys an extensive break after, you know, a long season, and particularly if teams do go deep in Europe or the URC, as Bert has already said, you can give them an extended extended 6 week break, completely refresh their bodies and their minds, more importantly. And like I'm the same as Bert. I don't, you know, whoever is playing the best at that time, I think should be playing for Ireland, you know, regardless of age or, you know, whether they're going to make it to the World Cup or not. You can work on that in the background. So giving those guys an extended period where they can really freshen up, get everything, have a big 6 week preseason where they're managed correctly back home, within their provinces, you know, that could see guys play another year or two after, or get them to a World Cup in 3 years' time. Those guys that are in their early 30s, you know, 32, 33, if they were looked after now, does that get them to, you know, does that get them to 2027? So that's what they have to decide. But I do think it's a great opportunity. And what's underneath? So say people would say, like, obviously Bundiaki is one of the best, probably our most informed player and has been for Ireland probably for the last 9 months. But if you give him an extended break, you know, long family time, good family time for 5-6 weeks, then you give someone like Jamie Osborne an opportunity, or Stuart McCluskey, or these guys that have been knocking on the door, and see what they're like. And as Bert said, then you're going back to, okay, well, now we actually have 3 to 4 12s that can fit in, that are all proven at test level. You know, from a back's perspective, I'm just talking about one position, but that's what can be done. And I think it'd be a good time just to freshen things up and go at it again.
And then obviously we just have to factor in what injuries are going to come up between now and the end of the season. And that also decides 3 or 4 places in the end of a squad like that. Looking at the tournament as a whole then, guys, I found it mad how, in one way, it's such a short little tournament, but then you look at how the opinions of teams have changed so dramatically over the course of the 7 weeks. Like, France going into it, we expected so much out of them. 3 weeks into it, we thought they were falling apart. And in the last couple of weeks, they've started to pull themselves up a little bit again, and they've shown us something. England, I think we thought were going to get better as the tournament went along. And then 3 games in, when they weren't doing so well, we didn't actually think they were going to get better. And now again, you know, there's green shoots over these last couple of weeks, and they'll be feeling good about things. The one that jumps out, obviously, though, Birch, who I think we haven't really spoken too much about, is Italy. Because they had to start the championship with England, Ireland, France is their first three games, coming in off the back of that brutal World Cup they had. New coaching ticket. Talk about a disastrous three-game start to a championship. And they lose against England, put up a decent enough fight. They get nilled by Ireland. And it would have been very, very easily for them to pack up and, you know, feel sorry for themselves. And then they come out and they go draw, win, win to finish off the championship. And I know they finished fifth out of sixth in the table, but it's hard to deny that's probably their best championship over their, what, 24 years in the Six Nations.
Oh, absolutely. What, they'd lost 36 Six Nations games in a row or something like that. And their World Cup, I mean, a 90-point defeat to New Zealand, you know, as recently as the autumn, and then to come out and bounce back. And I think Gonzalo Quesada deserves massive credit. In fairness, we have seen more decent Italian under-20s over the last 4 or 5 years. Italian under-18s can go toe-to-toe with Ireland and have done. But we worried where, like, what the effect of going into crap Zebre teams and crap Benetton teams, which at the time they were, would have on them. Obviously, Benetton over the last 5 years have got better, and Kieran Crowley was part of that. But now, you know, now they're in a playoff position in the URC. Zebre have got more wins this year than they have for a while. And you're looking at some players like Brex, like Menicello, who just look top end, like really, really top end, and in some pundits player or team in the tournament. So yeah, I think they will get massive belief out of this. They have a very nice game plan, a nice way of playing, and they'll get a hell of a lot better from it. And it's great. It's really good. And it's a big shock, I think, to the likes of Wales, you know, and even Scotland, I think, will be looking over their shoulder now at Italy. Going, you know, and you look at the age profile of their team.
Yeah, and particularly with the trend of the 20s as well over the last 100%,
100%. Yeah, like they could genuinely be, you know, sounds arrogant, but like regularly a fourth choice in the Six Nations. You know what I mean? With the potential to go higher. Whereas this Scotland team, and to finish off on them, like they must be. Where does Gregor Townsend go from here with them? I mean, another championship where they've just had a highlight of winning the Calcutta Cup match. You know, they got no joy out of beating Wales by the nature of the way it all unfolded. Near miss against a shit French team at the time, and then, you know, lose to Italy and lose to Ireland. And the way they lost Ireland, I know they defended quite well, but like it was a pretty poor performance by Scotland, and their age profile isn't good. So it's Italy are the surprise package of the tournament. I think it's great for the tournament. I think it's great. And I was really interested in Sam Warburton obviously getting abused because whatever, 3 years ago he said Italy should play in a relegation match, but he stood over his comments and he said, "Look, if Wales finish bottom, they should play in a relegation match. I mean, there's no one has divine right." And I wouldn't mind seeing that. I watched Georgia against Portugal. You know, I think it would add to the whole thing. You know what it would do? It would mean the WRU couldn't have done what they did and basically let the game go into disarray because the lack of jeopardy of having to worry about not being in the Six Nations allowed them to do that. So I actually think, if anything, it would mean the Italians couldn't have let themselves lose 36 games in a row. You know what I mean? It was just, sometimes I feel in Italian rugby and in Welsh rugby, or recently in Welsh rugby, the people at the top just got complacent. And that's jeopardy of potentially having to play a playoff would make it much riskier to sit in your hands. But I don't see it happening, but I think it would be a real boost to tier two rugby in Europe as well.
I don't know what you're thinking, John. I'd actually go a step further and just kind of add more like get rid of the Six Nations as an idea and make a, you know, a 10 team competition. You could have, you know, two divisions of five, bring it together for a final at the end or something like that, rather than kind of casting a team out and bringing someone in every year. I honestly just expand the whole thing and bring in three or four of the next best, you know, people have been talking about South Africa coming into it for years now as well. Bring them in if they want to come in as well, and make it a bigger, better competition rather than just leave it at the six. I don't know what you think.
Well, I think they do need to, you know, that's going through. I think Bert is on a working group, but like, I think the overall rugby season, you know, North and Southern Hemispheres has to be looked at. They have to come up with a kind of a plan where, you know, there is a better structure and a better aligned phrase across the board between North and South. I think, interestingly enough, you know, reading Richard Cockerell's comments after the game, you know, he's kind of said, well, look, we're probably better than this tournament. So they're, Georgia are probably stuck in the worst place in the world where they're probably going to win that tournament all the time. And they've, you know, they're at that level. But then only at World Cups are they pitching themselves against the teams that are better. And that's how you get better, by playing better teams. And they're stuck in that rut that's not there. So I think certainly to start, I think a playoff would be really good. It adds that jeopardy for everyone. For me, I think Italy have been probably the highlight of the tournament. You know, their turnaround has been incredible. And there is a lot coming through. I was away with an Irish under 18 development side last summer, and you know, they, in the games on the last day, they won all their games, and they won them fairly easily. Italy did, yeah. Like, you know, you'd come away going, you know, you go, Jesus, they have a real chance. If there's two or three guys on that team that you'd be expecting to be lining out for their under 20s team, you know, next year when they're out of school, potentially a year young, their results in their 20s have been excellent the last couple of years. Like, they are going to be pushing, and that's a worry for Scotland and for Wales in particular. Like, it really is. Like, Wales have obviously budget, you know, financial issues that are well documented, but where do they go? How do they have to start all over again. You know, Scotland the same, you know, like at that tournament, you'd wonder how many guys are going to, you know, if they're playing 20s in a year or 2 years time, how good are they? You know, it is a worry for both of those. And Scotland in particular, everyone was talking about this team as their generational side. You know, they have a couple of Calcutta Cups but you know, anytime they've been real, real contenders, they haven't been able to pull through on that. So it's not difficult times, but they have to figure out where they're going to go and how they're going to move forward with what model, whether it's like the English model where pro teams are working with schools and, you know, you're in they call it public schools over there, where people get bursaries from, you know, the clubs there to go to, you know, high level public schools and get training, but they're, you know, they're controlled by the academy over there, which is different to here, you know, or are they going to go down a model that we have here, which kind of all leads up to the funnel, to the top of the funnel, but they have to figure that out. And ultimately it all comes down to finances. You know, Italy have a way where their academies are based and the guys, you know, in Zebra and, you know, in Benetton, they're based there, they're in school there, so they get to know each other for long, and then they have a really good you know, external recruitment policy, bringing guys in and that kind of stuff. So they have their own model that is fit and working for them at the moment at underage. But, you know, Wales and Scotland in particular have to find their way forward.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, the entire rugby landscape in the Northern Hemisphere could look very, very different in the next 10 years. Final little Six Nations point, and this can be a short answer. Player of the tournament nominations came out yesterday. The shortlist: Duane van der Merwe, Ben Earl, Bundiaki, and Tommaso Menoncello. Who's your winner out of that four? Or if you want, you can throw in a write-in candidate. Birch.
Bundy and the fellow who should be on it, Brex, the Italian. I think, look, I love Manichello. Manichello's outstanding, but I thought Brex was class. But Bundy from those four.
Johnny?
I go Manichello just because he's Italian, and what they've done over the last, like, their transition has been incredible, and he's been one of the cornerstones of that transformation there over the last 9 months.
I'm going Manichello. Manichello wins. All right. We'll move on. Just a couple of URC talking points, because the URC is back this weekend. First of all, though, transfer news from yesterday. Billy Burns' move to Munster is complete. That was one of the worst kept secrets in rugby over the last couple of months, but it's done and dusted now. It's a good signing for Munster, Birch, I think, because if you just look at the way their out-half situation is, Joey Carberry leaving this year, it would have left them with Jack Crowley and what have we got? Tony Butler coming through, Dylan Hicks also in the academy, and Tom Wood as well. Like, it's... there's a lot of potential in their out-half stocks, even below Jack Crowley, but they did need an experienced option to come in there as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really good signing. I'm actually really excited to see Billy, you know, under Mike Prendergast. And I think Prendy obviously sees, and Graham Archer sees, a suitability in him to pull the strings of their attacking game, and it could, like, he could come back into the Irish reckoning, you know. Obviously on paper he's going to be second choice to Jack, but you'd imagine,
well, as long as he doesn't come into the English reckoning, I think Munster fans would be happy enough.
Yeah, well, if that happened, I think they'd throw their hat at it. But no, and obviously technically he will soon enough.
Qualified soon.
Yeah, he will now, but let's just say he's Irish for now. And I think they needed that. They do need strength and depth in the key positions. And yeah, it's very, very good. Like, I don't even would have... it's not expected, obviously, for Ulster's first choice at half to move to Munster to be theoretically second choice. But he's a very proud proud individual, and he knows if he can get ahead of Jack, you know, it's going to boost his chances even more. But from a Munster point of view, I think it's a good sign.
Yeah, and to touch on what Bernard said there, Johnny, like, we asked Graham Rowntree yesterday, like he said, he was delighted to sign Billy Burns, obviously, but he's admitted he was a little bit surprised that he was on the market.
Yeah, and I think, look, it fits everything because at the moment he's an Irish qualified player, so they don't have to use up, you know, one of their foreign players. We spoke about it on here before that, you know, someone in the mold of, say, Jimmy Gopperth when he came to Leinster, that, you know, that kind of older type, potentially Kiwi, Australian guy to try and pick on then from behind Jack and bring the younger guys forward. But Billy's very experienced. He's a capped international. And more importantly, he's an Irish international, so they don't have to use up one of their foreign player spots. So, yeah, look, it's a good signing, and you know, the competitive nature in Billy will be to push Jack all the way. He's not coming to play second fiddle. He's coming to get opportunity and make it a 50-50 call every game. And if he can do that, then he's pushing for potentially to play for, you know, pushing to play for Ireland.
The other transfer nugget that popped up in the last couple of days, we don't know really how much truth there is to it, Bernard, but reports in Australia that Leinster are potentially trying to take advantage of the financial troubles of the Melbourne Rebels by trying to get Taniela Tupou to cross hemispheres and come up next season. It would be a very, very expensive signing. Leinster, I think Jack Nienaber conceded that they are in the market for a prop, yeah, with Michael Olalatoa leaving. If that was to come to pass, all I can say is bloody hell.
Yeah, and look, it goes back to 2008 when Leinster got fed up not winning Europe and not being serial underachievers. I'm not saying this current crop are underachievers, but they're not winning. They haven't won the title since, was it 2018? And the Leinster board, the Leinster management said, fake this. And they went out and got CJ van der Linde, Easton Asiba and Rocky Elsom that summer, and they said, look, we're going for it. And if you get the Tongan Tour and RG Snyman in one off season, I mean, like, you're going to be odds on to win the European Cup. Like, given what's there already, it would be a phenomenal signing, whether he starts or impact. I mean, like, for me, both of those men, RG and him, they're a step above in terms of what they can do. Like, it's freakish what they can do. So, and if Leinster have a spot, a non-Irish qualified spot for foreign tight head, there's no one better that they could sign than him. I'll just say, obviously, a little bit of injury concerns in terms of his Achilles injuries, but he's back at the moment. He's been on the bench for the Rebels is he on the bench this weekend as well? But he's back fit at the moment, and he's under contract. But the Rebels going into administration will make him a free agent. I think that's why he potentially could be looking around. But that would be I know it would cause a lot of unhappiness amongst other provincial fans, but if you're a Leinster fan, if you're a Leinster player, if I'm a Leinster player, and as I was in 2008 when that happened, I was saying, well, fair play to the board. Yeah. They're giving us the tools to go and do it, you know? And I think likewise, you know, the Leinster squad and Leinster fans would be delighted with him signing. I don't know how much truth's in it. I don't know if the RFU would sanction it, etc. But it would be a serious statement, you know?
And I think that, like, from a recruitment perspective, when you look at that, you know, their first statement signing after Stuart left was Jack Nienbaar, you know, and then automatically everyone in world rugby, wherever you play, go, Christ, he's one of the best coaches, if not the best coach in the world. Right. Then RJ Snaiman, you know, you look at when it comes down to what they've lost in the final rounds of Europe the last couple of years, it's been that power game that has probably just not allowed them get over. So RJ Snaiman, okay, he fits that bill. When you get the phone call, whoever you are, they have a foreign player spot in that prop position, anyone in the world will go, right, they're really trying here. So, right, if I can get this deal done, I can have a real helping hand in getting a European Cup medal in my pocket. And worldwide, having a European Cup medal is massive from a career perspective. And I just think with the names that they've got now through Jack and obviously RJ Snyman signing, anyone, when they get a phone call from, you know, from Leo or, you know, in terms of trying to bring someone in, will listen, and they have the capability of bringing someone in. So it just shows the statement of intent that's there.
Leo Collins, you're getting the phone to Joe Schmidt, try butter him up over the next little while. Last little point before we finish up, because we've done a big pod today. Ulster heading down to South Africa this week. Richie Murphy gone in straight into the fire in terms of heading down to South Africa for a 2-game tour after coming in off the back of the under-26 Nations. A loaded squad as well. Jacob Stockdale, the only of the big names not to be in there. Dave Ewers as well, I suppose. Stockdale is, to confirm, he is just getting some personal time off. Himself and his wife had a new baby last week, and after a long Six Nations camp, he's been allowed to stay at home. John Fogarty also travelling down with them to do some scrum consultation work. It's a big test for Richie Murphy, this Bernard, but a big opportunity, particularly having been able to bring in the likes of Ian Henderson, Stuart McCluskey, and all the Ireland internationals.
Yeah.
And Rob Herring back from injury as well.
Yeah, they have really good players back. They've got a win, you know, a win over the Dragons in the downtime since Dan left. And Richie will go in there, fresh voice. And it's exciting, you know, it's a great opportunity for Richie. He'd be a little bit disappointed, obviously, he didn't win the Six Nations 20s, but to step up to professional level again, that's where he wants to be, I think. And being able to bring someone like Fogarty with him. Obviously, Dan McFarlane was looking after the scrum, so there was an obvious gap there. I think it's great to see the RFU supporting that, you know, by giving them their expertise on loan or whatever to help them, because I think we need to get Ulster back going in a positive direction. So yeah, I really look forward to seeing how they play, what changes he makes, but it is in the deep end, you know, it's in the deep end.
And like Johnny, he only has to look at, well, all of us only have to look at Munster last year as an example of these little South African tours can make or break a season. In Munster's case, it made it.
Yeah, look, it's an opportunity for Richie to go in, there's going to be a bounce back straight away anyway, from, because there's a different voice, you know, two different voices, you know, with himself and John going down. And yeah, I think, look, John's going to be brilliant for morale anyway, you know, on the Netflix docs, he's captain of crack, I think, but like, he's going to bring that kind of fun with him anyway, a new voice. And there's an opportunity here for Richie that if they go well, he can really cement his spot there. And it's a great opportunity. And one, I've no doubt, knowing Richie and how he plays, I think he's going to suit Ulster really, really well. Hopefully for him, really, really hope it goes well for him.
Yeah, so that's Ulster. They're taking on the Sharks in the first of those games, 1 p.m. this Saturday. Then they're down to Cape Town next week. In terms of matches this weekend then, so you got Munster away to the Ospreys Friday night. Munster 4 points and four places ahead of the Ospreys in sixth place. So there's a big potential swing there for whoever wins that one. There's also a triple header of games on RT2 and RT Player this Saturday. Women's Six Nations first up, France against Ireland 2:15. Also live commentary on RT Radio 1. And then you've got Connacht against the Lions. Connacht, the only Irish province at home this week. Similar sort of an 8 to 10 point swing in that game as there is in the Ospreys and Munster. So that's a 5:15 kickoff on Saturday. And then 7:35 also on the box is Zebre against Leinster. That is a 7:35 start. Bernard and Johnny, thanks a million for this week. Bernard, enjoy your next jet setting adventure. Florida, isn't it?
Yeah, Florida, Ocala. Yeah.
And Johnny, enjoy 4 knots on Saturday.
Yeah, can't wait.
Hosting Wesley.
Some difference. It'll be raining here. Anyway, but yeah.